it's Fern here, popping in quickly before the show because I really want to hear from you. I am forever grateful to you every single time you press play on an episode of Happy Place. And this show really is for you. So in the interest of doing more stuff that you love and less of the stuff you're not bothered by, I would love it if you took a couple of minutes to fill out a little survey for me. The link will be in the show notes. Your input on the content and the format and the guests and all those types of things is so important to help me and the Happy Place team shape the future of Happy Place. So just click on the link in the show notes to share all your thoughts and musings. I appreciate you loads. Hello and welcome to Happy Place. I'm Fern Cotton and this is the show that shares knowledge so we can all look after ourselves better. Today I'm chatting to Adele Roberts.
I'm not only grateful for having a stoma for saving my life, but also it helped me have a better relationship with my body. I feel bad that I've been so down on myself all these years, almost not appreciating what I had. I always felt odd. I always felt like I didn't look how I should. Having the stoma, it almost helped me disassociate from my body in the sense that I could look at it as this amazing thing that I'd been given by the universe to keep me alive. Like, I have the privilege of living in this body. This body has kept me alive. This body has survived cancer.
Adele is an award-winning DJ, broadcaster, and now marathon runner. In October 2021, Adele was diagnosed with bowel cancer. And in the months that followed, she, alongside her partner Kate, publicly shared the challenges of chemotherapy and life with a stoma, which is affectionately named Audrey. Just 18 months later, she ran across the finish line of the London Marathon, setting a new Guinness World Record as the fastest female with an ileostomy. Absolutely phenomenal. She also, by the way, had literally the worst night just before, up at all hours with Audrey misbehaving, and you'll hear that story in this chat. She's written a bloody brilliant book called Personal Best. It's part memoir and part self-help, and I really think it's going to be such a useful compass for so many people navigating life's biggest challenges. In this case, Adele's was cancer, but the mindset she's learnt is applicable to so many situations. This chat with Adele feels really important. She doesn't shy away from the details in her story. It's vital that we know the symptoms of bowel cancer. It's vital that we understand the reality of going through chemo. And it's vital that we can see from Adele's experience that the most awful circumstances can bring about amazing, unexpected, positive change.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Be warned, I have an incredibly croaky throat during this chat, so I'm going to scratch my way through it. Let's do it. Here's the show. Adele, I'm so thrilled to be having this chat with you today.
Me too. I'm buzzing to be here, Fern. Yay! Good to see you.
I love your jumpsuit.
Oh, thank you.
That's so nice.
I tried to not crease it in your honour. I tried to be presentable.
You're sat like
an
this.
Effort.
Yeah. I will not move.
I'm not in black for a change.
Oh, it's so good. I have to apologise. I sound like I've been out on the Raz. I haven't. I've just got no voice, and that's not good in my job. So I'm going to scratch my way through this chat. But you talking is much more important than me on this one. So we're just going to go with it. But I'm so thrilled to have you here. Congratulations on your amazing book. I've got a proof copy, not the real one. This is early days. I've got a proof of the book, Personal Best. How does it feel to have a book that you have completely poured your heart and soul into right there?
to see your hand holding my book that I've not even seen yet. So you've got that before me.
Which
wow,
is not cool or fair. I feel really bad about that. I'm so sorry.
No, I'm really happy that you've read it and I'm excited to hear what you think of it. But I think I never dreamed somebody like me would be able to write a book and also have things in there that hopefully help people. So I'm thrilled.
It's so helpful. It's so funny. Like, you have got such a great tone when you're writing. I was cracking up. The award for best opening to a book ever goes to you. Now, because my voice sounds like utter shit, could you please read the opening three lines of your book for us?
Amazing. Okay. 18 months ago, I thought I was going to die. I thought I was a dead woman walking. Now, Ian Beale from EastEnders is eyeing up my waffles.
Best opener to a book ever. I was like, I'm in. Yeah. I'm in. Whatever happens next, I don't care. I'm in. It's so, but that is, you set the tone from the start that this is a really thoughtful book and it's really raw, but it also has so much humour in there. And I'm imagining, like most people that have been to hell and back, humour is so important in changing perspective, in finding the little glimmers of light amongst the darkness. How has that helped you?
No, totally. I think it's essential in my life. I think that if you don't laugh, you'll cry. Yeah. And you won't stop crying. And there's bits in the book where I talk about grief and losing someone really close to me. And I went in a very dark place for a very long time, like decades. And I didn't want to make that mistake this time around. So I think I've learned to roll with the punches that life gives you. Try and laugh it off and go again.
Oh my God. Well, you have, and you're doing that. And it's a beautiful thing for us all to read about and learn about and to hear these stories. That's why I love doing this podcast, because it is simply storytelling and what we've learned and what me and the listeners can take heed of. It is so, so essential. So let's rewind back to October of 2021, where you heard the words that nobody wants to hear. It's cancer. What had led you to the doctors in the first place? Because this is a really important part of the book and your story, the symptoms that led you to that doctor's room.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for making sure we start with this, because it's the most important part of the book. I just hope that people that need to hear this hear it and it gets to those people. So I was ill for a long time, but I couldn't tell. I felt like I was in the best shape of my life. I was running a lot. I was quite small, so I was losing weight. That's one sign of bowel cancer. I didn't know that was a symptom. I used to get quite a sort of like bloated tummy a lot when I'd eat, but I thought that was because I wasn't cooking my food properly, because I'm not the best cook. So I blamed that on myself. And then eventually what happened was, when I'd go to the toilet and do a poo, I noticed that there were bits of blood. And I just thought, again, that was my cooking. But it started to build up and be more and more. And it was around the time of COVID. And I just didn't want to bother the NHS because I knew they were like overloaded. And I just thought, oh, it'll sort itself out. And then when it happened more regularly, I just thought, no, this doesn't feel right. This feels like it's a bit too much. And by the way, for anybody that's wondering, maybe they've spotted a bit of blood in their poo. It wasn't much. It wasn't like lots of blood. It wasn't massive clots. It was just little bits at the time. So if you're worried about anything, please do speak to your doctor. So I called up the NHS, but because of COVID, it took them about 6 weeks, I think, to get somebody to call me back. So I'd kind of been placed onto this system. But I think to them, hearing about blood was a trigger for them as well. So they eventually called me back and then got me an appointment. And when I went to see my GP, she said, you're quite young. I think I was 42 at the time. She said, because you're under 50, I don't think it's anything serious like cancer. I think you got piles. And I was like, yeah, it'd be piles. It'd be something like that. But she said, I'm just going to send you for a test just in case. And if she hadn't have done that, I might not be here. So essentially in that moment, that decision, I think, saved my life. And she gave me a fit test, and all I had to do was give them a sample of me going to the toilet, send it off. And it was about 2 weeks after that. And they said, oh, you just go to the hospital to have a colonoscopy, where they just basically assess you and put a camera up your bottom.
I've had it done.
Oh, really?
Do you know what? I had blood in my poo. I think we've got to just talk about this stuff, plain speaking.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I went and had a colonoscopy because I just thought, I want to know.
That's brilliant.
And luckily, everything's fine.
Thank God, yeah.
But you've got to check it out.
Absolutely.
You've got to check it out.
Yeah.
People get so scared, Adele. What do you do to get over that fear of, I'm embarrassed. I feel weird about this. I don't want to go to the doctors and tell them this. I feel vulnerable. How do you get over that?
Yeah, well said. I always used to be one of those people that didn't want any symptoms of cancer because I didn't want to know. But now I realise it's your body asking for help. And it's almost just like having a notification on your phone. It's like somebody's like sending you a message. So please know that the doctor wants to see you, that they're not going to judge you. They've seen it so many times before. It's what they do. It's what they're trained to do. They're there to help you. We're lucky to live in a country where we have access to free healthcare. Go and get seen.
Yeah.
Because that's how we beat cancer, by early detection, because it will save your life. So yeah, don't be shy. Get in there. I had the colonoscopy, and it was shortly after that that I got taken in to see the surgeon, and he said, yeah, you've got cancer. And I was just like, I think I say it in the book, I remember thinking, they think I've got cancer. It can't be cancer, but okay, weird. You know, it just felt so strange, because I just
thought,
surreal. I can't. Yeah. Yeah.
How do you, you can't process that in that moment. That is a lengthy process for you to get your head around the fact that you've got this diagnosis and it means certain things for the immediate future. It's so much to get your head around. One of the other things that you questioned in that exact moment, because you've got all of these thoughts whirring, you asked the doctor, is it my fault? Which I think is a very normal reaction, but it also maybe seems like it's certainly my personality type, but is that your personality type to think, I'm accountable, it must be something I've done?
Absolutely. Yeah, I totally thought that I'd caused it, that I'd been negligent. Yeah, I just wanted him to tell me the reason why I had cancer. So it must have been something I'd done. Yeah, my first thought was, am I going to die? Because again, another reason I wanted to write the book is to show people that there are lots of ways that, obviously I don't want anyone to ever hear the words you got cancer, but it's not an immediate death sentence. There's a lot of things that they can do, especially if they get you early. But once he kind of said he could help me, that's all I hung on to then. I just thought, I've got hope, I've got a chance. And if I've got a 1% chance, I'll take it and I'll run with it. And like you say, and then it was, oh, hang on, it must be my fault. And then he said it's not. And that's when the emotion came out of me. That's when I cried, because I just thought, getting emotional now. But I just thought, yeah, I'd done it to myself.
I think it's so normal. I think that, you know, that's the predicament we're in. We feel so accountable for everything in life. And actually, how wonderful that you had such a brilliant doctor who could say, no, and I'm here to help you. I'm going to take that away from you. I'm going to make this as smooth and easy as I can for you.
Yeah. And I think taking that shame away, I think shame stopped me ringing in the first place.
Yeah.
Because again, it's your bottom and it's poo and you don't want to talk about poo. So yeah, please try and let the shame go. If anybody's listening to this now and it resonates, please, this is your message. This is why you're hearing this. This is why Fern got me here today. Don't feel shame. You've not done anything. Do not feel guilty. Go and get seen. Get the help.
Yeah, like you say, it's early detection is imperative. It's
absolutely.
And it's game changing. It's game changing. And thank goodness that was the case for you, that I know you obviously had an excruciating week to wait to find out what stage you were at.
Yeah.
Even. How do you navigate that, those 7 big empty days of waiting? That's horrendous.
Yeah, you're right. It was a weird thing. So they said they thought it was stage 2. But it could be stage 3. And if it was stage 3, it would have meant that it had gone through the walls of my colon and it could possibly be moving around my body. And I thought, well, I need to tell my mum and dad, but I can't tell them because I don't know everything about the cancer yet. So I'm going to have to wait until I get the results. And that was about a week. And in that week, life goes on. You know, you go into that hospital as one person, you come out totally different, but the world's still the same. So you still have to go and DJ. I had to go and record an episode of Celebrity Mastermind.
Just what you want to do with that going on.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I didn't have to, but I chose to try and keep things as normal as possible because I thought in this week, once I get the results, I might not be able to live my life the same way again mentally. So just try and enjoy this week. And I think in a weird way, it helped retrospectively. And I also thought, just do your best to get through this week so that you can tell your mum and dad, because I wanted to tell them more than anything, to tell them that if I had a chance, I'd give it everything to be around for them.
It's so full on. And it seems like from reading the book, that was your mentality. You would just keep on as normally as you could, for as long as you could. And you were still going to work. You were still putting yourself out there to the public, which is a whole other bag of onions that requires energy and another mindset. But that helped you to keep busy, would you say?
Yeah, totally. That's the sort of person I am. There's lots of instances in the book of all the way through my life how I just try and focus on the positive. Because I really believe that if you put your mind in a negative place, it'll drag you down.
Yeah.
So I understand you can't control what happens to you in life, but you must try and control the way that you respond. And if you can give yourself that little bit of hope, if you can keep looking forwards or you can keep looking at the positives, to me, that's what helps me get through.
Yeah. I mean, you can see through the book like that, you had that mindset in so many ways. And we're going to get to running a bit further down the line, which seems to have a very similar mindset, actually, to everything that you've just been through. The other really important point that you make, and something that you've certainly educated me on more so and many other people, are stomas. So how much did you know about stomas before you had cancer?
Yeah, nothing. And I always say now, I'm not ashamed to have a stoma. I'm ashamed I didn't know what one was. I knew what a colostomy bag was, or at least I thought I did. I just knew it was a way of going to the toilet, but I didn't know that a stoma is an opening on the body that's been made by surgery. So I didn't have a clue. And the day that I got diagnosed with cancer, the doctor said, you might have to have a stoma as part of the surgery just to help you recover. And I remember thinking, yeah, fine. I just didn't really sort of like register it because there was so much going on. I was just like, cool. All right. Well, good. It's all part of the treatment. Great. And it wasn't until I met my stoma nurse that I started to learn a bit more about them that I was like, oh, they're interesting things. Mm. But I just thought, I didn't know until I had the surgery to remove my tumour if I'd get one or not. It was a case of they'd operate on me, see how big my tumour was, see how much work they had to do to fuse my colon back together and potentially give me a stoma. So until I woke up, I didn't know if I'd have one or not. And I thought, I'll just deal with that if it happens.
Yeah. Now, it's really interesting reading about your stoma because it's actually given you a hell of a lot. And I had underestimated this. One thing you say is that it actually has changed the perception you have of your own body for the better. Can you tell us a bit about that and why you think that's happened?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not only grateful for having a stoma for saving my life, but also it helped me have a better relationship with my body. Mm. I feel bad that I've been so down on myself all these years, almost not appreciating what I had. I think there's a lot of reasons for that, but I think one of the reasons is not really seeing people like me when I was younger on TV and on radio, and that's changed now, which is brilliant, but I always felt odd. I always felt like I didn't look how I should. And yeah, unfortunately, we didn't really have mirrors in our house as well when I was growing up. So I didn't really get to see myself. And when I did, I used to be like, oh, I just didn't like myself. And having the stoma just made me go, it almost helped me disassociate from my body in the sense that I could look at it as this amazing, wonderful thing that I'd been given by the universe to keep me alive. Like, I have the privilege of living in this body. This body has kept me alive. This body has survived cancer. And this body now has a piece of my intestine poking out and is still alive, is still going. And I was like, you are amazing. And it gave me that. The moment I got it, I was like, I've been foolish all these years. Look how incredible the human body is.
Do you know what? I wouldn't feel too bad about thinking like that for so long because I think we're women and we have so little choice, it seems, sometimes as to how we feel about our own bodies. We are bombarded constantly, and probably more so back in the day. You know, you and I, we were a similar-ish age, and we went through that whole period of like Heat magazine shaming people. And, you know, I was probably on that page. You know,
I was definitely after Big Brother. Yeah, I got it a lot. Yeah.
I had it after having babies, and it's just like, oh, fuck off, you know. And we've always been bombarded with it. Or even if you go back to sort of like 90s models and the whole aesthetic there, and we're still bombarded with it now on Instagram. And yes, there might be slightly more body diversity online, but I think there's still this weird pressure that it's meant to mean something more other than what you've just described it as, which is this amazing vessel that keeps us alive.
Yeah.
So I think most of us still really struggle with that and have days which are good, days that are bad. But some people have, every day's a shit day with their body and they don't feel comfortable with it. So I think the insight that you now have from the experience you've been through is such a beautiful gift that, you know, it's bloody hard won and it's not been easy. But to now have that comfort in your skin and to know that you have that gratitude for your body. That's what amazing progress. It's incredible.
Yeah. And it's weird seeing my stoma for the first time. I almost felt like that's me. It's like I could see myself for the first time in my life. It was emotional. And I just thought, I'm complete. That's how I should look.
Wow.
With a stoma bag, which is, I never had that on my bingo card for my life, you know?
But I mean, and you talk about this, the sort of complexities around, you know, it may get to the point where you have a stoma reversal, and that isn't going to be a straightforward thing of you going, yay, I'm back to how I was before. That would feel like a loss to you. You know, you've named your stoma, which I think is a really wonderful way, again, of coping with the change and having that sort of almost humanising what it is. It's Audrey. Yeah. We all know and love Audrey. That's going to be a loss if Audrey goes.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people who get stomas feel the grief of the loss of their old body when they get them. Like you say, for me, it'll be the loss of my stoma that will, hopefully I've done the internal work now to be able to accept my body when it goes back to how it was. I also feel very privileged and lucky that I will have a scar to show where Audrey's been, just as a reminder of what I've learned and how far I've come, and to appreciate myself. I talk a little bit about my mum as well and my sister in the book, who have a condition, ataxia, which slowly takes away the use of their body, both physically and mentally. And again, that's another reason why I appreciate that my body works, because it could be so different. There's no cure for ataxia. Whereas cancer, I had so much help, and with my stoma, there's so much help. So how could I ever complain, you know?
Mm, well, I think you've got a right to feel however you feel, but yeah. I think your mindset is outrageously brilliant, and it's certainly got you to where you are. The other interesting thing that the stoma has given you mindset-wise was actually quite early on in your story, after your operation, where you were learning how to get along with your stoma and how to change your own bag. And you had a night where you wept, and that was new for you. This was something that prior to you having cancer, you would shove emotions down, you would suppress how you were feeling. So actually going through this whole situation has allowed you to go, I'm allowed to ask for help, and I'm jolly well allowed to cry.
I love that, Fern. Thank you. You're right. You make me feel emotional now thinking about that. Most of my life here, I didn't cry. And remember Kate saying when I had my tumour removed, I FaceTimed her. She was the first person I FaceTimed after I'd woken up. And she just said that the light was back in my eyes. And I really believe that that tumour being taken away took away so much negativity and so much like self-hatred. And I'm so glad that piece of me is gone now, because I feel like I'm almost like allowing myself to be the person I should have always been. And crying is part of that. I understand now crying is not a weakness, it's strength. You know, it really is. It's strong to show your emotions. And I always had it twisted. I had it the wrong way around. And yeah, if, you know, I wouldn't wish cancer on anyone. And I'm sad that I had to put my family through that, but it's given me that.
I'm going to get you a tissue, my babe.
Thank you.
It's a bloody good thing to cry.
Yeah, it
it's
is.
It's a bloody beautiful thing to do.
Yeah, and it's, thank you.
You know, we should, it's, but I get it. You know, we're not necessarily taught as kids to freely cry and to freely feel emotion. And I know that you went through certain things that probably pushed you down the wrong road even further. You talk about losing your auntie Maxine and how that was the start of something you've alluded to already in the chat, feeling a bit broken and not being able to access those emotions and actually feeling really shit and shit about yourself. So can you tell us a bit about Auntie Maxine, why she meant so much to you, and then and how her loss impacted you?
Yeah, my Auntie Maxine was amazing. She was my mum's sister, and she was like a second mum to me. I just adored her. She was one of those people that lit up any room that she was in. She was so positive. She was powerful and beautiful and intelligent. And she was all the things I wanted to be. And she was just cruelly taken away from us when she was only 42. She was ill, I think with pneumonia, or that's what the doctor said. And within 3 days, we'd lost her. But it was just like a sudden shock. And I think that in my life, a lot of things had happened to me that I sort of like just buried and got on with it. But that one seemed to just like rock me the most. It was almost like, okay, now I really understand life's not fair. You know, that really felt like a cruel trick that life had played on me. And that felt bad feeling that way, because I was like, she's not even my mum. Like, my cousins have just lost their mum, and here's me feeling so sad. But I just thought she just didn't deserve to be taken away, you know, in the prime of her life. And yeah, that one sent me off the edge. And I just thought, I'm done now. I just did almost like, it's not like I didn't want to be here anymore, but that's when hope went. That's when I always had hope as a kid that things would get better. But when Auntie Maxine died, that was the day that hope died for me. And so I went on Big Brother. So that was just
I found this a really
the most bizarre thing to do.
Adele, I found this so interesting in the book. You know, we have our coping mechanisms. And do you know what? Thank you for explaining that, because I really, grief is so complicated. And I really understand how you've just articulated it, that you had this guilt because she wasn't your mum. So you felt like you didn't have the right to have those emotions. And of course, when we go through something shocking and out of the blue, that cements a certain reaction to many things in life. So I totally get how you've gone down that road of, I just don't do emotion. I'm not going to, even if I'm feeling it, I'm not going to show it. And you talk about this extreme reaction, which was to go on Big Brother to escape the pain.
Yeah.
It makes sense.
Absolutely. I was hiding in plain sight.
Yeah.
I just thought, I don't want to deal with life. I don't want the guilt of seeing my cousins and being upset and not being able to be there for them. So I'm just going to run away. Where can I run away to? And when I was feeling like that, I saw an advert for Big Brother and I just thought, that'll do. And it, like you could just pick to be on Big Brother, but it just kept choosing me. They kept asking me back. So I was like, okay, cool. And because I was like young, I was like 22. I just thought, what's the worst that could happen?
What is the worst that could happen?
Yeah, but that's a whole nother book, Big Brother.
Yeah,
I was hiding in plain sight. I ran away from life. That's the only way I think I could cope with it.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
So I'm very interested in this. So when you started to access that emotion and this, and cancer being the catalyst and you having no choice, I have to let go, I have to surrender, I need to let this emotion up. Did you feel like the dam had been broken? Like emotion was just flooding out of you at that point? Or was it an incremental thing that you had to sort of get used to?
Yeah, I have to get used to, you, like you say, the dam's broken, but I'm always getting used to it now. And I'm always having to allow myself to grieve, allow myself to feel. It's a daily process and a daily practice. So that is one bit of advice, hopefully, that can help people that maybe are like me, that used to bury their feelings and not cry and not let them out. I think you've got to almost let the feeling flow through your body and just let it out. And one of the ways I do let my emotions out now is through running or walking or just expressing myself. But it is a daily practice. And I've had 42 years of doing it the wrong way. I've only had, how old am I? 45? 3 years of doing it the right way. Yeah, a better way. A better way. Yeah. So yeah, it is. I don't know about you, but you've got to always remind yourself, haven't you?
You do. And actually, I'm okay at it, but I do always have that thought of, how dare you cry? Who do you think you are crying? People have got far worse problems. Yeah. And I don't think that's helpful.
No.
I think it's our natural instinct because we are empathetic and we want to look out for other people and be aware that there are other things going on in the world. But I don't think that should mitigate what we're feeling.
Absolutely.
I don't think that's helpful. And I do think it's so healthy to cry, to feel angry and to let it out in a good way.
Yes.
To feel euphoric joy, even when bad things are happening in the world. We've got to be able to feel it all. We've got to. Like, that is the natural human way. But I think, like you say, it takes real practice. Another part of the book that I think is extremely helpful for people that are either going through cancer at the moment, have a friend or a loved one who has cancer, is talking about chemotherapy.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is incredibly common. There will be many people listening to this podcast now who have had it or who are going through it or who have a loved one that are going through it. And you talk brilliantly, again, about the excruciating discomfort that you go through with chemotherapy. And actually, a real emotional side that I maybe underestimated was that You felt like you were having bits of yourself taken away, vital, essential parts of yourself. The parts of you that made you you felt like they were being pulled away from you. I'm sure that was something that you weren't necessarily expecting.
Absolutely. And I didn't realise how, like you say, life-saving and essential chemotherapy is. I felt so grateful to be on it. But you're right, I wasn't ready for the cure to be the cause of so much pain and to almost be worse than having cancer, and daily as well, especially at nighttime. I think I talk about like the night terrors when it would really affect me, when my feet and hands would feel like they were burning, like they had hot pokers or somebody was like stabbing my feet. And you know that you need to feel this way. It's almost like a trial that you feel that you have to get through, but it also hurts you so much because your spirit, which I think I tried to hold on to as much as possible, is slowly being eaten away by this chemotherapy and eroded. You know, a sense of self is so important to be, I think, happy in life, you know, and to have my fingerprints slowly being erased.
Yeah, I didn't know that happened. You educated me hugely on that.
Yeah. So my fingerprints didn't work. My hands hurt. Were so sensitive because of the neuropathy that was caused from the chemotherapy. But then, yeah, my fingertips not working, and it rearranged sort of like my facial features. It took away the hair on my body. It burnt the skin on my face. It gave me a black spots on my tongue. It took away my, as I've walked through your house today, the beautiful smells, you know, like your candles.
All the candles on.
Yeah, gorgeous smells. But when you're on chemotherapy, the things you love to smell and eat and taste, you don't love it anymore. And sometimes it makes you feel sick. And you're like, it just slowly takes away everything that gives you joy.
So what got you through that period? Because that's bleak.
Yeah.
And it's bleak for anyone going through it. It's not fun. This goes back to a mindset. What mentally enabled you to get through that?
I think I just decided to stick to the things that my stoma nurse had given me, which was walk for 20 minutes every day. So I thought, no matter how much your feet hurt, Adele, no matter how tired you are, you must walk for 20 minutes a day, because that is something you can control and that's something you can at least try to do. And sometimes those walks ended up as shuffles. Sometimes I had to call Kate and be like, my feet feel like they're on fire. Can you come and help me to get back home? Which happened a few times. But I just thought, if you can chalk off today, get to the end of the day, chalk it off. Don't worry if like you failed on some of the things that you tried to set out to do. You get up again tomorrow and you go again. And it was that little bit of hope that kept me going. So it was just understanding, yes, it was going to be tough, but what can you achieve tomorrow? Can you get out of bed? Can you get yourself washed? Can you go for a little walk? And just the thought of that was just my happy place. Yeah. And I know that sounds like really basic stuff, but can you just try and do it?
I think happiness is the basic stuff. I think it always comes back to it. You know, the amount of times I have, do this podcast, and it's the basic stuff.
Yeah.
It's the everyday gratitude, it's the everyday experiences that make us human, that give us that happiness. But I think when you've hit rock bottom or you've been through something extremely challenging and that's all you've got, you really then start to realise, these are the foundations for me to feel okay.
Yeah. Sorry, there's just one more thing I've just thought of actually. Just in terms of mindset, because some people might be listening to this and they can't physically do stuff. My mindset was, I thought, if this is hurting me like this, imagine what it's doing to that cancer. So I just used to have almost do thought experiments. And when I couldn't move, I would just visualize the chemo going through my body into my bloodstream and just finding those cells and taking them out. And that gave me so much happiness. I was like, yes. Destroy. It's like, yes. Call of Duty, but inside my head, you know, I was just like, kill that cancer.
Was there any moment during any of this lengthy experience where you lost hope?
Yeah, definitely. There were a couple of nights where I was in so much pain that I did question, why me? I did feel sorry for myself. It had defeated me. But then I'd just try and lie there and just try and get my mind back on track. But yeah, there were a few times when I was just like, what have I done? It was almost like I was looking up to the sky to be like, why, you know, why is this happening? What have I done? I just wished I could like... It felt like I was being punished for something, and I was like, what is it? I'll apologize. I'll apologize straight away. Just please, like, let me not feel this pain. But then I realized it was all part of me getting better. It was part of the process. And I think letting go of all of that guilt and shame that I held inside me for so many years. But yeah, it definitely got me a couple of the nights.
Yeah. Which again is the most normal thing.
Yeah.
I think you'd have to be a robot to get through it without having those moments of huge doubt and
yeah.
moments of surrender and
surrender, definitely. Yeah. Yeah, that is such a beautiful word, and that's another big lesson I've learned with all this. Sometimes you can just lie back and let it wash over you.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's the best thing to do until you can get yourself back on your feet again to go again.
Yeah. Hey, I really appreciate you talking about all this because I know it's not easy to revisit these moments that were fucking awful and painful and soul-destroying, but I know you want to be here because you know it's a helpful conversation to have for other people, but
yeah.
I really appreciate it because I don't take it for granted that going back over this old stuff and things that you are still moving on from and moving with, it's not an easy thing to do. So I really, really appreciate it, Adele.
Thank you.
I'd love to talk about running.
Yes.
Especially as you are a Guinness World Record breaking runner. What an accolade.
I know. How brilliant is that?
Oh, it's just fantastic. And I was whooping for joy reading all this brilliant stuff about the marathons. And you actually came to running very late in life. So you were 37, which again, I think is a really important thing for people to hear. Not just about running, but anything. Thinking you can't start something a little later down the line. You don't have to start something age 12. It can be down the line that you pick up an instrument, start reading for the first time, whatever the hell it might be. But it was running at 37. What took you to running?
Yes, amen. I just want to say that again, everybody that's listening. I know you know this already because of this brilliant podcast, but it's never too late to start again and to change your life. Absolutely. It was my sister actually that inspired me to run, my little sister. I just remember being lazy in bed one Sunday and seeing that she completed a Race for Life, a 5K that she'd done for our auntie, who sadly also had cancer, who absolutely smashed it, my auntie Anne. She had breast cancer and she's 10 years clear of breast
yes,
cancer.
Yes, Auntie Anne!
Yes! She's one of my heroes. And at that time, I didn't know it was for me in the future. But I remember seeing my sister doing this 5K and she did it from scratch. I didn't even know how far a 5K was at the time. I was like, is that far? And then when I realized it was 3.1 miles, I was like, I can't believe my sister's just done that. No training, just done it out of the passion in her heart. And I just remember slobbing in bed, probably eating last night's pizza going, oh God, you can do better, Adele. Like, that's your little baby sister. You should be doing something. And that's when I think I started to turn my life around and was like, right, no more moping anymore. Get yourself out of bed. Not that day. I'll probably just stay in bed.
In a few weeks' time, I'll start this running thing.
But I think that's when it clicked. And I was one of those people that'd be like, I'll start Monday. And then I didn't start Monday. But eventually, I did start the Monday.
Yeah. And starting running, let's be honest, isn't fun.
No, it's not.
It's not like all of a sudden you go, oh, I'm running 5K. It's easy. You know, it takes time, but it's worth persevering. When did the mental side of it click in? Oh, this feels good mentally. Because, you know, I'm certainly not running because it feels great physically. Sometimes I am, but sometimes I think, oh God, everything hurts, can't be bothered. But for my mind, every damn time I get that mental clarity, or even when it's post-run, I'm like, oh, something's just relaxed mentally. At what stage in your running experience do you think that hit?
Yeah, it took a long time. I just started with walking.
Yeah.
I got a little stepper band off my friend and I just used that and it had like little challenges on it and I just worked my way up. So once I'd started like walking, I feel like it's almost like once you unpick one part of your bad habits, you can start to address the rest and just give yourself the time. So once I started walking, I was then like, oh, maybe I could like start to tweak what I eat. And then I started to tweak what I watched and what I listened to and how
that's
I dressed.
That's so important, P.S. I think we forget about watching and listening to things. We don't put that in with food and exercise, but it is so important.
Amen.
Are you watching absolutely awful, violent, whatever it is stuff, or are you watching things to inspire you? That's going to have an impact.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Huge.
Yeah. Anything that you take in through the senses could be helpful or it could be junk. So if you see TV as junk TV, just, yeah, if you try and see it like that, sometimes you'll start to get in tune with what makes you feel bad and you'll be like, actually, I don't even like that program. Yeah. It makes me feel rubbish.
Does it give you joy or does it make you feel like absolute crap?
Yeah, yeah. So it was a knock-on effect, but it started with the walking and I started to see self-care as something that was good and not selfish. I think I used to think I was being selfish if I actually cared about myself. So I'll use anything I can now to make myself feel positive and to keep myself on track, because again, it's a daily practice. There's a very lazy person sat inside of me that doesn't want to go running.
Use it something like there's a lazy sloth inside of you, but you have to be like, no sloth, we're everybody. Running.
So it took a long time, but eventually, like you say, even with the running, I whinged and hated it. And my first marathon, my poor producer who worked with me at Radio 1, they will tell you I whinged all the time. Like, honestly, I must have been such a nightmare. But once I'd got fit enough to not worry about my body, like you said, your mind's free and you're like, oh, this is glorious. But it took a very long time.
Yeah, it does, which I think also ensures people don't give up if they're on the sort of beginning of their running journey.
Yeah.
And there are some days still you think, oh, this is awful.
Totally.
But it's still worth doing it.
Amen.
Still worth doing it. So let's talk about your most recent marathon, because it was only 18 months after your life-changing operation where you were out there on the streets of London running a marathon with a stoma.
Yeah.
I mean, this, and also at 3:30.
When you say that, I forget the time. Like,
what? I don't understand. Like, it's just mind-blowing. And I'm not saying that with any level of, you know, being patronising. 3:30 is fucking quick no matter what you've been through. 3:30 is like you're a professional athlete, Adele.
No, it's my personal best. I'm like, how could I run it faster with a stoma than when I had my intestines inside my body? But that's mindset for you. And I think that's the difference, because I had no business running that marathon that fast with the body that I had. It wasn't in good nick. It's even more fit now, my body, because I'm a year on. But that's mindset, and that is belief, and that is really going after something and committing to it. And I think that is me saying, I know you've sworn a few times, so I hope you don't mind, fuck you cancer. It's like, no, just no. I just got myself to the point where I was like, I am not going through that chemotherapy and getting this stoma and it not mean anything. It's like, I'm going out in style, you know. It's just like,
you did that. I mean, one of your friends, Ian, had said to you previously, running is 80% mindset, and you'd been a bit like, oh, bless Ian, yeah, sure. And actually you're like, yes.
Yeah, totally.
True.
Yeah.
It's not about, it's a bit about your body. You know, you have to have a certain level of fitness, but you can still get out there and run if you are able-bodied and you can go and do that. But actually what's going on in your brain is more important than anything.
Amen. And I think the mind leads and the body follows.
Yeah.
And I think that goes through all areas of life. And that's why I hope that this book can help people, whether they are unfortunately dealing with cancer or they're about to get a stoma and they're not quite sure what it's going to be like. Or maybe they're not a runner. They're like, I don't want to run, because my girlfriend Kate does not want to run. She's not interested in those chapters.
She's not inspired by your 3:30.
Not at all. No. Not at all.
I love it. She knows who she is and she's cool with it.
I like that.
But
I think life just throws those curveballs at you. And I think that hopefully the mindset side of this book will help people no matter what they're facing. You know, whether it's like grief, it's the end of a big relationship. Because I think that to get through life, and what this podcast talks about a lot is mindset. That's what I got from your book, Happy. It's the mind. No, totally. Like that, I mentioned a book reading challenge in my book, and you're in there. Like,
oh,
you
mate,
helped
so
make
lovely.
This happen. So thank you.
Oh, don't. I'll cry. Fucking hell.
Yeah.
That means a lot. And you're right. It's mindset, and it doesn't have to be about one specific thing. It can be just about, you want to get out of bed a bit earlier each day.
Yeah.
Or you want to stop gossiping or whatever it is. It's mindset over everything. And that's enabled you to do just the most incredible things. And may we add on top of that, the night from hell that you had before the London Marathon.
Oh God, yeah. I'm like, which night? Because Audrey's so naughty.
I was reading this book and I felt sick for you, because I am obsessed with sleep, because it's not guaranteed with me. So I get really panicky about, even if I've got a podcast, I won't go out and do anything in the evening before, because it might disrupt. And that's too much. I know I've got to address the balance. I'm a work in progress. I'm very happy to say that. I've not mastered any of this stuff, but I don't trust myself. If I go out, if I get back, I'm overstimulated and then I start thinking about things, I won't sleep. It might mess up the podcast. I don't want to do that. So I'm really like nerdy about my routine and sleep and yada, yada. I can't imagine things going so tits up the night before a marathon and you still managing to do what you did. Tell us about this awful night. I was shaking reading this bit of the book.
Yeah. So,
because you want the perfect night's sleep before a marathon.
Without
That's
a doubt.
That's all you want. You just want to sleep for 8 hours. It's not a massive ask. Oh, mate.
So the night before, it's a rookie error really for me, but it's because I was making it up as I was going along. There's not many people that have run a marathon with a stoma, so I didn't know what to eat. So I decided to eat mashed potato and porridge the night before.
Is that normally okay with your stoma? Like what?
Yeah. It's palatable with a stoma.
Right.
So it's easy, digestible food. Really, if Audrey had her way, I'd be eating sausage rolls, anything beige, like any processed food is really good.
Heaven.
Because it's already been broken down by industry and you just almost like put it in your body and it melts away and it goes in, whereas I can't really have like veg and fiber anymore. Anything with like a skin on, I can't break it down because that gets done in the large colon, which I can't use at the moment. So it's almost like I have to have like just really easy to eat food. So I thought, right, mashed potato and porridge oats, I'll have that the night before and then I'll be okay and I'll be full of like glycogen ready to run the marathon. But Audrey didn't digest the porridge and the mashed potato and decided to chuck it out my body at 3 a.m.
And you feel I'm deep breathing about this one.
So you feel the tingle. I get woken up all the time by the tingles of Audrey. So I'm like, is she still in her bag or is she going wild? As she managed to break the seal on the bag, because what your stoma can do is, if stoma bags aren't an exact science and they're still being worked on, so they stick to your body with like this sticker, and if you have a naughty stoma, sometimes they can get the sticker off and just escape, and
wow.
Then it's basically like having an open tap on the front of your body. It just comes out and you can't control it. So I'm like the exorcist spewing like porridge and mashed potato in a fancy hotel. So I like jumped out of bed, ran into the shower. It's doing its thing, spraying it all over the shower, but then my pajamas are ruined and then it got stuck in the shower. So then I had to like, the shower started flooding because it wouldn't go down the plug hole. So because it was fancy, it was like one of those flush to the floor showers.
Oh, you want a shit shower in this situation, not a fancy one.
And then it all comes out from like the shower door and it just like floods the actual bathroom. So I'm there with no clothes on, cleaning a posh hotel bathroom of like porridge oats and mashed potato at 3 a.m. And Audrey's just like,
Yeah,
just like, yeah, great.
And then you can't get back to sleep.
Yeah. So then I'm lying there thinking, God, it's 3 a.m. I need to be up at 6. What am I going to do? And that, like you say, that anxiety just keeps you awake then. So I tried to go to sleep, but I just pretty much lay there like that.
It's horrendous.
Yeah.
But this is, again, a really important life lesson for any of us on just a regular day to not write off the success of a day because you haven't slept. And I used to do this all the time. I'd go, oh, well, today's absolutely screwed because I didn't sleep and it's all going to go to shit and I'd be so dramatic. And actually, I'd get to the end of the day and go, well, that was all right.
Yeah.
Like, there's no drama. I did the job and everything was fine and I'm a little bit more tired than I'd be normally, but it's fine. You not only managed to get over that, you know, the would-be drama, you managed to run a marathon in 3 hours 30.
Yes.
It's ridiculous.
Now you're saying it, I'm like, how did that happen?
How?
But it did. Actually, do you have pictures in that book?
Yeah.
Oh, did they put the picture in of me? Did they? Stalkers.
Oh.
Did
they put that one in?
Yeah. There's
a picture. Passed me by. No,
because I took a picture to show Kate what Audrey had done because I didn't want to wake Kate up. So I took a picture to show her, but no.
Is it one of the beginning of the chapter pictures?
Oh, no.
They're the only ones that are in there.
Right.
So you're going to have nice glossy pictures in the middle.
Yeah.
Ooh, love a book with glossy pictures in the middle.
Yeah.
No, I've just got the lovely ones with the songs.
Yeah.
I can't believe you haven't seen this. This is
no,
unbelievable.
Yeah.
So I've got nearly a complete copy. But also you're putting in the picture of you. Wow.
Well, I submitted it, so I don't know if it's been vetoed, but there's a picture of me with my stoma change bag covering Audrey in my private parts, just like, great, 3 a.m.
What's going on?
Yeah.
What's going on?
But like you said, thank you for saying that, because no matter how your day starts, it can always end well.
It can.
Don't write it off.
And sometimes it's really surprising because actually you do end up going, oh, fuck it. And then everything does go a bit better because you're not so determined or so like focused or whatever. You're just like, fuck it. And you go with the flow a bit more.
Absolutely. I've learned to become less attached to the outcome. Mm. And also decide how I think things are going to be. I allow fate to show me now. I'm like, oh, yeah, it's not. I think as humans, we try and sort of like decide from our experience how a day's going to go. But like you say, when you let the universe take over, it ends how it's supposed to. And you're like, ah, that
and
was better than I thought.
It's scary doing that.
It is very scary.
Because you've got to just let go and be vulnerable. But it's really interesting. And you've obviously been forced down that lane, whether you like it or not, that you've just got to go with the flow. Mm-hmm. But now to see you can sort of continue thinking in that way and carry it into regular days, I think that's an amazing mindset shift. One I certainly haven't managed to make fully. And you know, talking to you today has inspired me so massively. And I don't want to use that. Inspired is such a weird word because people fling it around randomly, but I truly mean it. Like reading this book and talking to you today, I think it will have the exact impact on the listeners today that we can all think about things in a slightly different way, having spoken to you, in terms of how you surrender, how you go about your business, what your mind's doing, how much control we actually have over our mind. And one of the most important things, which I think we started with, so it's a nice place to end, is being nice to yourself.
Yeah,
absolutely. It's really hard. But again, that lesson for you has been hard won, but you've learned it and you're doing it. And it's, again, it's a daily discipline, something you have to keep coming back to, but it's so important.
Absolutely. And that is something that your podcast does in abundance and you've helped me with that. So thank you very much.
Oh, mate.
Yeah.
Adele, I love you. You're amazing. I love this book. I've loved every second of this conversation.
Me too.
Keep smashing personal bests. Keep doing your thing. You're bloody brilliant.
Thank you, Fern.
Oh, Adele, I don't know where to start. That was one of my most favourite Happy Place podcast episodes. I just loved Adele's honesty and her storytelling and the fact that she is willing to really bare her soul and her true emotions to all of us whilst telling this important story. As I said in the chat, it's not easy to recount difficult moments like that, so I am full of gratitude. I learned so much from that chat. It's definitely reset my mindset somewhat and how much more I could push myself, and sometimes I do get a little bit stuck in my ways, so it's had a profound impact on me without a doubt. Personal best, Adele's memoir is out on the 11th of April. As always, I want Happy Place to be a space for you to share your stories too. Did you resonate with what Adele's been through? Come and carry on chatting over on Instagram at Happy Place Official. I'll be back here next week, but in the meantime, the biggest thank you again to Adele, to the producer, Anushka Tate at Happy Place Studios, and to you, because you are ace.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to this show ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.